I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
I just want to welcome everybody to Functional Nerds. This is where people go who can't afford San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh, that's right. That's going on this weekend.
That is this weekend. Yes, they're dropping trailers like crazy. Yeah. How they expect anyone to go back to work after dropping a Clone Wars trailer, a new Clone Wars television series, I don't understand.
I know. We have to, our next, just the two of us, we have to get in deep with that. Yes. But today we are joined by Mary Robinette Kowal. She's got one book out right now, but a second book in the duology coming out soon. So we have The Calculating Stars, which is out now, and The Faded Sky is coming out in August. And they sound like very interesting books. And Mary, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Amongst other things that we will get into, one of the reasons we wanted to get Mary on the show today, because this is her second, at least second. I know we spoke with Mary at Capricorn in Chicago a few years ago, according to one of our listeners, almost 4 years ago now, not the two that Patrick and I previously stated.
You mean the listener that I call Capricorn Joe?
Capricorn
and sometimes
Joe.
I call him Cannoli Joe.
Cannoli Joe too as well. Capricorn Cannoli Joe. Yeah, I pointed out that it's been coming up on 4 years since we were at Capricorn and talked to Mary live, one of the few live Functional Nerds podcasts that we did. But a couple of weeks ago when we had Andy Weir on the program, actually picked Mary's book. And if you haven't listened to that episode, I suggest going back and listening to it because there's an interesting story. So, Mary, why don't you tell us a little bit about what Andy had to say about how he came about reading the book?
It's hilarious. It is, I think, my favorite story of how someone found my book. He gets a lot of books to blurb. This is a side effect of being a writer. I get them too. He has a different method for dealing with his than I do. He throws them away, the ones he's not going to read. I recycle them or give them to people, but he throws them away. And I respect that choice because there's a lot. And so he was in the process of throwing my book in the garbage when the back cover blurb did its job. and he saw the words in an alternate 1952, asteroid slams into Washington, D.C., and he thought, okay. And then he saw the words hard science fiction and Apollo era space and started reading it.
And hasn't been able to put it down since.
Apparently not. He's apparently still reading it. I mean, actually, he may be done by now, but he's tweeted that he's farther into it and still liking it. So I'm like, again, thank heavens for good back copy on the book.
That was awesome.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, Patrick and I have spoken about it before, but when you're in this field, especially as an author, and if you have a certain amount of success, that's part of the relationship that you have is that people blurb, and it's kind of a trust system. Mary, you could probably get into it more than we can because we don't get books to blurb them. We get them to have guests on the show. But for the blurbing, that's kind of the way it works. When you're an up-and-coming author, if you get a couple of good blurbs from some bigger name authors, that can really help. And then it's sort of the other way around. Then if you're at a level of success, then you can kind of help the people coming up too. So is that just sort of, you know, part of the expectation of being an author these days?
Yeah, I get a lot of books. I don't get as many as Andy does, because he's higher up the hierarchy ladder than I am. As soon as you have a film come out, everybody wants you. but I get a lot of books, and I don't blurb them all. My general rule for blurbing is that I have to have read the entire book. Because there can be a book where I'm like, hey, the writing style in this is fantastic. And then I get deeper into the book, and this happened actually, get deeper into the book, and it can be appallingly problematic. So I'm like, nope, I read the entire thing or I don't blurb it.
I got asked one time to blurb a book. And luckily I liked it. I read the whole book. I liked it. And I sent the blurb off to the
Excellent.
Guy.
Nice.
Yeah. It's interesting because the blurb serves two functions. One is to try to catch readers. But the bigger function for a debut author is to get the sales team excited about it, and also to get like the sales team that's in-house, but also booksellers interested in it, because it gives them some talking points.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. And I think it also helps in terms of validation, because I know, you know, what we're all prone to that. That's how we're wired. If I pick up a book and I see five of my favorite authors blurb it, well, of course I'm going to take a closer look at that book. It's like, oh, okay, this person likes it, this person likes it, this person likes it. Chances are I'm going to like it. So it is kind of an important function of it. But I think that's true too, because then it's this whole kind of, you know, almost food web mm-hmm. or something, where it's the authors, and then, like you said, the publicists and marketing then want to go out. And then for people like Patrick and I who have a podcast, or people who maybe do a book review blog, or all the different outlets for getting the word out about it, it's like, yes, if Patrick and I then get interested in something, then it's like, well, then we share that with yeah. our listeners, who then maybe some of our listeners write a blog or post about it on Facebook. Like, and that's just how it all works. It's like a big whole thing. So those initial blurbs, I think, kind of help get the ball rolling on all of this stuff. So that's part of it. But yeah, I know I am in the same boat. Because I just moved, I haven't been getting as many books. But yeah, it's I always say it's a great problem to have, because I love books and I love reading them. But at some point, you're just like, well,
I know.
And I did find a good place now, because my library used to take them all. And a couple months ago, they're like, yeah, we're not taking them anymore. And I'm like, oh. Because I used to feel great about that. It's like, good, they'll go to the library, they'll get at circulation, or they'll sell them like through their like library book sale, and someone will enjoy that book, and that will help the author because it'll get out there and promote the book more, or they'll, you know, I always felt fine about it. And then when they stopped taking them, I was sad. But now there's another in the town that I live in. There's it's like an adult literacy organization within the town. So they just have like a big book drop that's like a clothes drop. And so I'm like, oh, great, because they'll take everything. And it's either, like I said, it's either going to be go towards these literacy programs, or then they sell them, and then that money goes towards a literacy program. So I feel good about that it's like, okay, now I know I can give them here, and they're going to help reading or help the author or something. And my conscience is clear, because like I've thought about throwing these out too, and I especially with the ARCs, because you can't really get rid of them, and it's like you feel horrible throwing a book out, but sometimes that's kind of your only option. Or
it is one that I can't find a home for, then I do recycling. I don't And even that is really hard, because books are precious things. You know, this is the way, like growing up as a reader, I'm like, and that was what I spent my allowance on. Books are really, really super precious. And then at a certain point, when you start getting into the ecosystem of books and you learn about remainders and all of these other, you know, copies of books that actually people don't want that physical copy, it's like, okay, I can learn to at least put them in the recycling bin, but I have to put them in the bin like right before it goes out, because I can't keep walking past books in the bin. It's upsetting. Mostly what I do is on sunny days, we have a neighborhood that a lot of people walk in. And so on sunny days, I put them on the front stoop with a sign that says free books.
Nice.
Because their purpose is to advertise the book, and word of mouth is super important. So I don't do it before the book has come out, usually. I usually do at least wait till release date.
I've had to come to terms with the fact that like the local library here was very upfront with me. They're like, yes, we'll accept all of those books. We'll immediately sell them and use the money to buy stuff people want.
Yeah, that's a little rough, but yeah, sometimes they might actually do, because I know in most of the libraries that are in my area, there's a pretty good genre section. So I did.
Yeah, as far as I know, they've never kept a single book. They've sold every single book I've ever donated.
That's too bad. That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it actually makes good sense. Let me explain to you what's going on there. when libraries have books on the shelves, they need particular bindings that often they are getting. This is why you get hardbacks mm-hmm. at libraries. And often they're a library bound hardback, not always, but because there's a life cycle in how many times a book can be read before it falls apart. So the process of keeping, of getting a book in, you have to pay someone to catalog it. You have to pay someone to get all of the identifying material on it. Then they have to shelve it. And then there's maintaining it. So a free book is not actually free for the library.
Okay.
Which is why they won't just shelve anything. And also shelf space is at a premium. So they're constantly having to cull books that aren't getting checked out. And that's why they say things like, we're going to sell these and buy books that people actually want, because they're keeping track of what books are being requested, what people are checking out frequently. They know the population that they have. So that's why that happens.
Gotcha. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And unfortunately, I've tried to recycle the ARCs, and they reject them because of the covers. And they say I have to take the covers off of the ARCs in order to get the ARCs recycled.
Really?
They'll recycle the inside pages, but the glossy cover, they don't want that. They're like, we can't recycle that, or we have to do a different program for that or something. Yeah.
Interesting.
That's been kind of fun. Anyway.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well,
it's not easy.
No, it's not. Well, before we get on to our next section, I want to take a moment to thank everybody that backs the show. If you enjoy these interviews with folks like Mary, I want to thank the people that are already backing us, and that is over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. For those of you who aren't backing us, consider becoming one of our backers. It really helps us put on a good show and get cool folks like Mary on the show. So if you want to do that, just go over to patreon.com/functionalnerds, and you can pledge $1 a month, a couple dollars a month, whatever works for you. I haven't really spoken about it in a while, but just to explain Patreon for people that don't know it that well, it's basically an ongoing Kickstarter. I think most people in our audience know what a Kickstarter is. Patreon is a way, and it's a great thing for podcasts to put out content every week like we do, where it just becomes a, hey, I'll give that podcast $1 a month because I enjoy listening to the show, and it's a way to help. And it really helps cover the costs of things like Zencastr, which we're using to record, and hosting, and all of those kind of things that go into making a podcast each week. That helps us cover those costs, and it makes it a lot more fun for us. And it just really, for us, was great to know that, oh, a lot of people like the show because they're willing to give us a couple dollars every month. And that's great. So if you're not doing that, consider doing that. Patreon.com/functionalnerds. Now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Mary, why don't you go first and let us know what your pick of the week is?
So my pick is Breaking the Chains of Gravity by Amy Shira Tettel, and it's one of the reference books that I used when I was working on The Calculating Stars. This is the story of spaceflight before NASA, and it is fascinating and engagingly written, and it covers all kinds of information that I did not know, like how early rocketry started. We have this kind of idea of it just suddenly in the United States, of it just suddenly blossoming when someone said, hey, let's try to get a man on the moon. And really, there was stuff going on really, really way earlier than that, like in the early, early 1900s, like in the teens, there was stuff going on. And really, there was some stuff that was going on in the late 1800s, but it didn't get off the ground, so to speak. thank you.
Hey, I make the puns.
I'll be here all week. Yeah, I'm over the moon to be on the show. There's no shortage of them. There's really no shortage. Anyway, this book is fantastic. And if you, so highly recommend the book. But the other thing is that Amy has a web series called Vintage Space, where she covers different aspects of historical space programming. And like really will dig into deeply, deeply nerdy details. It is fantastic. It is where I learned about the NACA, which is a real thing, which is the NASA precursor, and interestingly pronounced NACA, not NACA.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, highly recommend Breaking the Chains of Gravity by Amy Shira Tatel.
Very cool.
Nice. Patrick, what's your pick?
Well, my pick, I'm late to this party. I only watched this after it was done on network TV and hit Netflix. But I'm picking Black Lightning.
Oh, right. So you write a post about that.
Even wrote a post about it. Yeah. Because it's such a great show. I think it's actually, I think I put something in the post along the lines of for people who are looking for something that is, more positive for an African-American community, I think Black Lightning does a better job than Luke Cage.
Okay.
And, Black Lightning is all about this community that is predominantly African-American. It's about how, he's a principal, and he kind of stopped being a superhero and focused on being a school principal and on educating the kids in his community and helping them and empowering them that way. And it's this huge story about community and family. And then there's superhero stuff too, So the superhero stuff comes back and never really goes away. But it's such a great story about, like I said, community and educating kids and empowering kids. And I just loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I know some people had talked a little bit about it on social media at the time. I was like, oh, another CW superhero show. No, not another one. I don't have enough time to watch another CW superhero show. So I waited until it came on Netflix, and I'm kind of kicking myself for doing that because it was just amazing.
Very cool. Yeah, that, I kind of had that response too, because I find this stuff, I love all that stuff, but I wait till they all come on Netflix and I just started watching.
I know
those
you
stuff
do.
Now.
I don't. I typically try to watch them, in season.
Yeah, I've kind of gotten out of that habit with stuff. But yeah, no, I'm looking forward to getting to that one eventually after I catch up with everything else. And I might even try to turn my son onto that, because I know one of the daughters is played by China. I can't think of what her last name is, but she was the lead on a Disney Channel show called Ant Farm, which we watched all last summer, and he really enjoyed that. So I might be able to hook him into stuff that I like because he'll recognize her from it. But that's very cool. I will check it out. My pick this week is a movie. I don't often pick movies because I don't actually watch a lot of movies, but I'm going to pick Baby Driver. And I ended up watching that because I was out to dinner with a couple friends, and he said, like, oh, did you watch that Rush documentary? And as people who listen to the show a lot, I'm a big progressive rock fan and I love Rush. And I said, yeah, I watched that Rush documentary. I'm like, the one, the one from like 5 years ago. It's like the whole career of the band. It's on Netflix. And he's like, no, that, not that one. They put a new one out about a year ago. And I'm like, no, I never even heard of it. And he said, yeah, it's on Showtime. And I'm like, I don't have Showtime. And I looked into it, and Showtime is, and I think at the time, if you're listening to this on post day, you might have a few more days to do it, but the Showtime is offering a free 30-day trial period if you do it, like, I don't have cable, so if you just do the Showtime, whatever the Showtime service is called, you can get it through Hulu. That's how I did it. I think you could do it as an add-on through Hulu and Amazon. So you could do it for free for 30 days. So I did that, and I watched the Rush documentary. And I was interested in Baby Driver, so I watched it, and it's awesome. It's such a good movie. It's directed by Edgar Wright. I will say this, it is quite violent. So if violence turns you off, then it might not be for you, but it's basically a heist kind of movie. Like, they do bank robberies, and the one main character has earbuds in the whole time and has to listen to music. So it's a lot of music. It's a lot of just, rock songs blaring as they're robbing banks, but it's very stylish. Jamie Foxx is in it. John Hamm is in it. It's a very good movie. I really enjoyed it. So my recommendation is the Baby Driver movie, but I'm also going to recommend getting Showtime for a month for free, because that's a good deal. And the Rush documentary is good. And there's a bunch of good music docs up there. I watched a Beach Boys documentary. I know the Eric Clapton music documentary is up there. So even if you were just interested in watching some music docs, get Showtime for free for a month and watch all those music documentaries. Well worth it. So Baby Driver, that's my pick. Okay, Mary, now you mentioned NACA, and this was, as we were speaking to Andy Weir a few weeks ago, he thought that was a fictional organization. And as you told us in your email, it is not.
No.
It is not a fictional organization. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about NACA.
Sure. So the NACA was a real thing. It was the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. And it was, when I said that that rocketry and all of this had been going on for a long time, the NACA was founded in 1915.
Wow.
Granted, most of what they were focused on initially was airplanes and World War I and trying to get caught up. But they were the first testing facility for trying to get things off the ground. The first testing facility was in 1920 at Langley, and they, you know, started building wind tunnels and all of these other things, full-scale aircraft, and working on getting the speed up. And then they started looking at trying to do rockets. And a lot of that was specifically for trying to do, because of what Germany was doing with the V2s, a lot of it was in an attempt to address that. But they were very, very early into this. A lot of the stuff that they were doing with rockets specifically began in the 50s with the Cold War. But the NACA was hardcore. And then in 1958, that's when Congress decided to create NASA, which was a civilian space agency. I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows why NACA is pronounced with the letters and NASA is pronounced as a word. It is just weirdness.
So NACA was in the 1915, you said?
Yeah.
And NASA was when?
1958.
Well, we were a lot lazier by then.
Yeah, basically. So, yeah, exactly.
We're just going to say it at that point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the people who were at the NACA got folded into NASA. I mean, it was, and then they added additional facilities like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which was doing its own research separate from the NACA. Those all became kind of NASA. And although JPL still operates somewhat separately, there's this big umbrella organization now. So it's really fascinating. And again, Amy's book was, the Breaking the Chains of Gravity was one of the places that I learned a lot about the NAC in it. And she gets into a lot of the early formation and the people working. And of course, one of the other things about it is that there were a lot of women working there with doing computing. So they were doing all of the calculations and things like that.
You know, Mary, one of the things in the sort of promotional material for your books, they mention Hidden Figures, but mm-hmm. I suspect you were writing these books before all of, before that movie came out, before that book came out, I suspect.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I wrote Lady Astronaut of Mars, and these are prequels to that in, I think, 2011. It was quite a while ago. And I turned Calculating Stars in October of 2016. So, and Hidden Figures was, I think it came out in September of that year. I'm not sure, but no, the book came out in September. That's right. The book came out in September, but I saw the trailer for Hidden Figures, and I was like, it's my book. Oh my goodness. No, here's an interesting thing about what that book and film did. I have a lot of characters in the novel that are based on real women who were real computers during this. And my beta readers were saying, oh, wow, you know, I really love how the alternate history is allowing you to have women of color where there wouldn't have been any. Or I don't really believe that in the 1950s, these women of color would be there, even in this alternate history. And I'm like, these are real women. And when Hidden Figures came out, that complaint completely went away. And this is, wow, so this, that's yeah. Cool. And this is one of the things that I keep talking about. It's like, this is a really clear example. If you need one, if there aren't enough in the world of why representation matters, this is one of the things that happens to us. We internalize these narratives. And, you know, in this case, the idea that the narrative that people had internalized of spaceflight was wrong, that it was only these, you know, chiseled white men. But JPL had a policy that, first of all, for the computing department, they didn't hire men. They wouldn't. They hired only women. And then the second thing is that when you were being hired to work there, you were asked how you felt about working with Black people. And if you were not comfortable or hesitated or anything, they would not hire you.
Hmm. Well, and it doesn't help that for 40 years, Hollywood has always portrayed NASA in films and stuff as being predominantly white.
Yeah.
You never saw, and all male, you never saw anybody else in any of those movies.
Right, right. And one of the things that's also really fascinating when you look at why the NASA facilities are where they are. So the launch centers are all about orbital mechanics, right? But right. All of the non-launch centers are predominantly in the South, right? Huntsville,
right.
Houston. The reason that they went for the Huntsville facility instead of one in Kansas, there were a number of different munitions facilities that could have been converted to creating rockets. The reason that they were putting them in the South is because they needed to get, first of all, the South needed funding. It was very poor. And so that was a work initiative. But the other reason was that it was forcing segregation to happen. Or desegregation, excuse me. It was forcing desegregation to happen because they were United States government facilities.
Interesting. One of the other things that you brought up with that, which I noticed over the course of last year, is even on some of the TV shows that I watched, there was definitely an episode. There's that NBC show Timeless, which is the time travel show. And whether you like that show or not, it doesn't really matter. But they did have.
I know people who love that show. I liked it.
I watched the first season, and there is an episode where they go to the 60s and they're at NASA and there are African American women working there. Now that might be just like a nod to Hidden Figures. It might have just come out. I'm not sure, but that was there. I feel like there might have even been like an episode of Legends of Tomorrow where that was kind of a thing too. But as you said, Mary, like that's one of the reasons why representation is important, because all of the sudden I don't ever remember seeing that kind of aspect of NASA represented in any kind of show. Now you have these sort of light genre shows that are on every week, and within two of them that's a theme on two different shows for two different episodes. So I think it's interesting how it just kind of reveals things that were not out in the open before.
And I think it comes down to you've got people making these television shows and movies now who are trying to show actual history and show what happened.
Right.
And it kind of reminds me, if you remember, like all of the big spectacle Bible movies, right? There was an agreement. There was an agreement between the movie studios to only show like positive interpretations of Bible stories, right? They were never going to do anything that didn't portray things in a positive light. That was kind of like their shtick. I almost wonder if there was the same sort of agreement about stuff like this. It's like, oh, well, we're never going to show those women who were the computers. We're never going to show those. We just can't. Yeah, I don't know, but that's what I feel like.
Yeah, you know, there were definitely decisions being made because of racism and sexism. Mm-hmm. Whether or not those were formal decisions, I don't know. But I do know that there were a number of things, deliberate decisions made across the board, not just in Hollywood, but wages. One of the reasons that women were paid less was a wartime decision that in order to encourage the women to leave the workforce when men returned.
Yeah.
They wanted to make sure that the women were paid less so that the men who were the breadwinners, it would be more worthwhile for a married couple for the man to be the one the man working. So that was a very deliberate decision to drive women out of the workforce.
Joy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's a lot of things like there are a lot of decisions that people made that are all about suppressing women and people of color. And one of them being things like, keeping the all white front because that's more respectable.
Right.
And it's maddening when you realize that there are these really racist decisions made that then we are continuing the work on because of the stuff that we've internalized and are regurgitating.
I remember when I first started playing guitar and I got into the blues and I started playing a lot of blues songs and finally got up the courage to play in front of my family. And I played a couple of songs that Eric Clapton had recorded over the years. And my uncle, he recently celebrated his 80th birthday. So probably at this point in time, he's in his 60s. And he comes to me and, he's from Arkansas. And he's like, oh, dang, I remember that song. I used to play that song in the honky tonks back in the day. He's, of course, we had to change the name. And I said, you changed the name? He goes, well, yeah, you're singing about a black girl. We couldn't do that because we were white.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I never even thought about that at all. And the song was Alberta, Alberta.
Right.
And he's talking about how he had to change the name to make it so that the white folks would appreciate the song.
Yeah. I mean, I say, oh, wow, as if I'm surprised. But it's also like, yep, no, there it is again.
Yep.
Yep. Now, Mary, with the writing of the books that are going to be out this summer, one of the things that I found interesting is that you had some astronauts write jargon for your stories.
Yes,
is that true?
That
Maybe
is true.
You can tell us a little bit about that. How did that come about?
So I got really lucky. I met and became friends with two astronauts, Katie Coleman and Chell Lindgren. And they initially were just consulting with me on things, but at certain points they would send stuff back, and I'm like, "You've actually more or less written dialogue here." But what would also happen is that the way I write, when I have a detail that I don't know, I'll just put it in brackets, and then I'll go and research it later. Unless it's like a very specific plot point, but most of those I researched when I was doing the outline. So this is all stuff that's color details, right? So I would have sections where it would be like, and then the captain turned to me and said, jargon. And I flipped the jargon and said, yes, sir, I've just jargoned the jargon. And I'm not actually exaggerating here, because I knew what the emotional arc of it was going on. And I knew that really what I needed for them to be doing right there was to be demonstrating competency. So then I would send it over to, I had also a rocket scientist, Stephen Granada, who helped me, who was like reading the entire book. And so I just started CCing when I would send stuff over to him. I started CCing Chell and Katie on my Mad Lib sections, and they would fill stuff in. And one of like, they would take turns. Sometimes one of them would say, oh, Katie should take that because that's, she's actually flown one of those. And I dealt with this other type. And it was fascinating also watching them interact. And so it was a lot of fun. Chell caught a timeline continuity error. He read the entire book. And in the early draft, some of the language that I was using was shuttle era. And
oh.
Right. And so he's like, this engine type and these sequences don't exist. And you've also got people worrying about the abort path. And with, which is something that you can do with the shuttle. You can steer the shuttle back to an abort landing site. You can't do that with one of the capsules.
Yeah, weren't they just basically launch and if something happens, eject?
More or less. It depends on where in the launch sequence something goes wrong. But yeah, it was basically, welp. there's a reason Chuck Yeager called them spam in a can.
Yeah, I know that I'm not saying anything that people haven't said or thought about before, but you know, just the way you were talking about that with the abort sequence, and I think early on it was just, well, we're gonna, it's just the daring,
yeah,
that it took to do all this. And I know it's something that people have brought up before, but when you think of the timeline of the development of flight and space flight, that it's like, what are the Wright brothers? Is that 1913, I believe, something like that? It's in the teens, I think. And then you figure man on the moon at 69. That's like such a short amount of time from going from flight to space flight to landing on the moon. It's, yeah. I'm not saying anything people haven't said before, but
are you
it's
saying,
really incredible.
Are you saying REM has been around since 1969 and that's when they recorded Man on the Moon?
No, I'm not saying that.
Oh,
but,
okay.
No, but it just goes to when you think about the space programs and what they did in such a short period of time and how, yeah, like I said, just so daring, mm-hmm, to do this. It was not a leap of faith. There's obviously intense amounts of science and research that went into it, but in the end someone had to get in that rocket.
and at one point Karen Burnham is a SF signal irregular, and she used to work for NASA, and I want to say she quoted a number that was like a percentage of our gross domestic product that went into putting someone on the moon. And it was like an astronomic, just crazy number.
Yeah. And
I don't
that,
remember what that was.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I remember that it was, we were throwing a lot of money at it. But still compared to, you know, defense spending and things like that, it was not that much. But part of what I was looking at in the book was in my novels was what would have happened had we continued throwing money at the space program at the pace that we were. And, you know, I had to drop an asteroid on Washington, D.C. to provide some incentive for that. But
I would have my flying car and my goddamn jetpack.
Probably. Although there are legal, like the flying car, I don't actually want anyone to have a flying car. We have enough wrecks with regular cars, and air rage is not something I want to experience. Thank you.
I think flying cars would all be like AI controlled. They would just go on a certain path at a certain speed. You would have no control over it. That's what I think the perfect flying car is.
Well,
you're not driving it.
Sure. And I will trust that flying car with the AI when I can get my phone to reliably make a phone call for someone. Like, I mean, it's, we have this idea that AI are going to be able to make decisions better than humans can. And that may eventually happen, but the process of getting there is going to involve a lot of people dying. And that may shut it down all by itself. For instance, do you know when the first bus from London to Bath was?
No,
I do not.
So if I said 1805, you would do a lot of what? Actually, I think it was 1830. Anyway, point being, early 1800s, there was a regular steam-powered bus line in England. And then there was a horrible accident. And in addition to the horrible accident, the carriage drivers objected to the general idea of these steam carriages because they were losing money. They could see a future in which they would lose money. And that technology got shut down. Had that not happened, you know, we totally would have had, cars way, way earlier. Similarly, the Hindenburg was all it took to shut Zeppelins down completely. So just because a technology is available and something that can work doesn't mean that it's going to get adopted.
Right. Yeah. And you know, I always talk about the jetpack, and John DiNardo inevitably sends me some sort of message saying, you'll put your eye out. You know, in other words, something bad will happen. You can't handle a jetpack. People will die. There'll be stupid people doing stupid things, and tons of people will die, and that's why you can't have a jetpack.
I mean, and that's basically it. It has to be something, and this is why with automobiles, those got adopted fast enough that regulation wasn't happening. And also they were getting adopted before there was really instant reporting. So, and that was one of the things that changed with the Hindenburg, was that was a mass casualty that was, people were able to instantly report on. With the internet now, people will outlaw the stupidest, like the fact we can't have Kinder eggs with toys. You know, they won't outlaw guns, but they'll outlaw candy. They'll outlaw useful things. I find historically it really suspect.
If we're going to talk about this seriously, which I try not to ever do, but you know, how often are you driving in your car and the giant sign over the highway or over the road or something, you know, the electronic sign is talking about it's click it or ticket weekend, or, you know, put your seatbelt on or you're going to get a ticket. You know, you constantly see those. And yet, to this day, school buses have no seatbelts. And the reason school buses have no seatbelts is because they say it'll just be too expensive. It'll just be too expensive to retrofit all the old school buses that are out there in use to put seatbelts on them. Never do they talk about, you know, well, we'll start putting them in the new ones.
Right.
And then eventually we'll catch up. It's that, no, it's just too expensive to put seatbelts on there. And just here about a week ago in Colorado, we had a school bus accident where the school bus rolled over.
Oof.
And all the kids got, you know, jostled around because there's no such thing as seatbelts in a school bus. So click it or ticket, put your seatbelt on, you're going to get a ticket unless you're in a school bus.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just stupid to me.
Yeah, it really is.
So anyway, John. We've gone off the pier and into the ocean here. So
no, that's okay. But I was going to say, as we're kind of starting to wind down, one of the things I wanted to ask Mary before we run out of time is your books are a duology,
correct?
And the Calculating Stars is out now, and The Faded Sky is coming out on August 21st. We see this sometimes in publishing where they publish books in a series close together like this. And what are your thoughts about this? Were you all for this? What are your feelings about publishing two books in the same series within basically 2 months of each other?
I was super excited about it when they approached me about it. I had written the first book and begun the second one. And they said, what do you think about pushing the release date of the first one and having them both come out back to back? And I was like, yes, how fast do I have to write the second one so that we don't really have to push the release date? Because we were talking about having them both come out next year, and I just didn't want to go that long without books out in the world. So that was part of why I wound up doing a lot of Mad Libs for the second book for the jargon, because I was writing at a really accelerated pace. But the reason to do this, and you know, we go into bookselling nerddom here. There's a known thing that happens in publishing, which is that the first book in a series comes out, you get a nice, it always sells more than the later books in the series. The second book in the series comes out and it always causes a bump in sales for the first book. When the last book in a series comes out, you will see a bump in the sales of all of the books, because a lot of people will wait until the series is finished. So if you can have books come out back to back, like I've seen trilogies that come out one after the other, 1 month apart, what you do is you give enough time for the people who've read the first book to get excited about it, to put in a pre-order for the second book. And then when the second book comes out, you see everybody who was waiting for both books come out buy both books. So you get all of these nice effects in this very concentrated period, which then makes it slightly more likely. It increases the possibility that the second book will land on a bestseller list. And sometimes it increases the likelihood that both books will suddenly land on a bestseller list. So that's why they do it. And also still one of the best ways for promoting a book is word of mouth. So if you can have the books come out back to back like that, that means that people, there's a greater concentration of people talking about those two books happening at once rather than spread out over, you know, 2 years. So that's why they're doing it. And I was totally on board with, yeah, let's try this thing. It is, from a writing standpoint, brutal. I do not understand how the people who do self-publishing or work in genres where they are doing multiple books a year on a regular basis, I don't understand how they do that. Because like I would turn in, you know, here's book one, and then turn in book two as I'm getting edits on book one. And I would finish the edits on book one, and then I would get the edits on book two, and then I would get the copy edits. It was just, I have been doing nothing but these books for basically the last year. And I love space and I love these books, but it is really intense. And then the other thing is, you know, you have a new book come out, the 2 weeks leading up to it, you're kind of pumping people up, getting them ready. The book comes out, and then, you know, the week of the book release, you're talking about the book. And then there's another like week or two where you're still trying to keep people active and engaged. And then you can kind of taper off. What's happening is, you know, I've got that week or two of getting people still excited about the first book, but I'm about to have to start pushing the second book, which is interesting as an experience. It's an interesting experience and not something that I thought about when we said, let's do these two books. So I'm basically going to be still living and breathing these books through like October, I guess, September, October, who knows? I have launched into orbit and I appear to just be there now.
So I've been to plenty of book launches at Tattered Cover in different places and book signings where the author goes up and talks a little bit. And especially when there's a series of books and, you know, they're launching a new book in the series, they struggle because how do they talk about it without giving away spoilers? Because you always have that mixed crowd, right? You've got mm-hmm. people who have never read the first book and they're there to buy it along with the second and the third kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then you have the people who are on the third book. They devoured the first and second book and they have tons of questions to ask you that are all spoilers for the third book. So, you know, that's when books come out every year or every 2 years.
Yeah.
You're going to have fun because you're going to have both books out at the same time. And you're going to have people who've read the first book and want to ask you all kinds of questions that might spoil some stuff for people who haven't read it yet.
You know, I will say one of the nice things about these books for me, because they are prequels to a story that takes place 40 years in the future of the main character. Mm-hmm. And the story is called Lady Astronaut of Mars. There's no real spoiler. It's like, I wonder if Elma is ever going to get to Mars. I wonder. Huh.
gosh, do you think she's going to be an astronaut someday? Allie, I don't know. This book is called A Lady Astronaut Novel. Maybe. So there are a couple of things in there that are emotional spoilers. Like there's a couple of, but they're not like the major plot, you know, there's not really anything that I think you're going to spoil for the major plot. There's, it's very clear where we're going to land.
Gotcha.
The question is, it's all emotional stuff, which is stuff that comes in the reading. It's all the how we get there. It's the effect that it has on people around her. It's the effect it has on her. It's the cost that she's going to have to pay to go. Those are the things that are interesting. And those are also not things that I feel like are particularly spoilery, because this is not a book that is structured about surprise.
Okay, gotcha.
Right. Now, so you're talking about sort of getting the word out about the books. Do you have any con appearances or any other kind of appearances that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
Why, yes, I do. Thank you so much for asking.
Okay.
I'm going to be at WorldCon, naturally. I'm also going to be at BubonaCon with John Scalzi as guest of honor. And then we're going to, on the launch day for Faded Sky, we're going to be at Poison Pen in Arizona, because Scalzi and I are driving from WorldCon to BubonaCon. So we're road tripping the week of the book launch, which expects some shenanigans. I'll just say that.
I was going to say, I'm expecting a ukulele songs from Scalzi through that whole thing. I think he's going to be, I can imagine him sitting in the passenger side, you know, writing songs about your adventures.
Yeah, we do want him to arrive alive at the at the convention. That's just, you know, kind of a goal. But you know, I could list everywhere that I'm going to be. I'm also going to be like at Left Bank Books in the end of August, doing the East Coast launch. And I also get to go look at the Apollo capsule while I'm there in St. Louis. But the easiest thing for listeners to do is to go to my website, which is my entire very long name, and sign up for my newsletter. It is basically, we just periodically say, hey, this is where Mary's going to be. And every now and then you get a recipe or a free story. You get a free story on your birthday, actually, if you sign up for my newsletter.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is very cool. All right. So
do you use variable data to tuckerize their name into the story?
Ooh.
Ooh. See, I'm an email data marketer, so I can help you set that up.
That's a really good idea. I could actually totally,
I got the gears working now.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to think about that now. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Yeah. So for everyone listening to the books we've been talking about, it's The Calculating Stars. That's out now. And The Faded Sky is due out on August 21st. So go and pick those up when they're both out. Did you do the audiobooks for these, Mary?
Yes, I did.
Yes,
I did indeed.
People who may not know, Mary does a lot of work as a voice performer for various things, including different books and other people's books as well, not just her own. So I was wondering if you did yours. That's very cool. So is the audiobook for The Calculating Stars out currently?
It is out currently. I have already finished recording Faded Sky, so that'll be out on release day. You get to hear me. So because Elma is Southern, I do the whole thing and it's first person narration. You get to hear me doing this for the entire book. And then the other thing that I do, which is fun, which I don't get to demonstrate in print interviews, is suddenly occurred to me that I can actually demonstrate for you how all of the comms sound when we're doing that. Nice. What I have just done is I have put a cup over my mouth.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
Trade.
Yeah,
that is. That's very effective.
So I spent a lot of time in the booth with a red plastic cup over my mouth.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. So,
glamour.
Yeah, for Yeah, because obviously our listeners are audio people, and I know a big part of our audience consumes books that way. So yeah, go and check out those books audiobook wise as well. Well, very good. Mary, anything else you want to let our listeners know before we wrap it up for today?
I will just let them know that I think you're awesome. And that's basically it.
Aw, thank you.
All right. Very good. For us, once again, thank you for listening. Thanks for those who are supporting the show. And if you aren't already, consider going over to patreon.com/functionalnerds to do so. Patrick, anything you want to leave people with?
Nope.
All right, everybody. Well, have a great week, and we will see you next time.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.